Welcome to hour number one of Culture Shift. Yes, that song. It is that song. What is Old is New Again. Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush came out in 1985. It's the number one song in the world right now. How did that happen? And is the obsession with older music a problem for new musicians? Well, Culture Shift's Ryan Patrick Cooper is here to chat with me more about that. Hey, Ryan.
You rarely see this cultural moment, Rob, where a song is placed in a show like Stranger Things, which is already a massive Netflix hit, but then becomes this whole other thing on top of that. I mean, this is the highest performing charts that this song has ever done. It is introduced to a completely new audience. And there's so much to think about when this happens. You know, older music selling better than new music. If older music is more popular than new music, what happens to those newer musicians? Yeah. As you said, we only have 2 years. We can only listen to so much music in a day. Yep. And what's the money behind this? What are the forces at play that might be controlling a larger algorithm we don't see every day when it comes to these high-profile placements? Well, this was also on the mind of Nate Rogers, a writer and editor based in Los Angeles, who recently wrote a story for The Ringer called Kate Bush, Running Up That Hill and the End of Music Charts as We Knew Them. Nate, welcome to Culture Shift.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
So, for your experience of writing about music, intellectual property, all these different things, is there anything shocking about a song like Running Up That Hill by Kate Bush coming alive again in 2022?
I think on the surface, there's nothing really that surprising because there's a long history of old music kind of popping up through media and becoming popular again. But I think what really stood out about this one is the magnitude, you know, the way that it became so much more popular than it really was when it came out. And it was a popular song when it came out. You know, so I think that's what really stands out about this case that makes it kind of fascinating.
And a big part of it is the way it is placed in Stranger Things. It isn't just used one time. You make the case that it's actually pretty central to the plot and one of the pivotal characters.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, a little light spoilers for anyone who's still catching up with Stranger Things, a lot of seasons now. But it's used centrally as a motif throughout the fourth season. Character of Max, it's her favorite song, and it kind of is used to save her from, you know, in a demon. And so I think that attachment is a little bit more dense than it usually is for just a normal music sync. And that's played a pretty big role in kind of getting people's interest. And it's also the most popular show in the country right now. So, you know, add those things all together, you have a little bit of a perfect storm. It's kind of the ideal music sync for an artist.
And when you say music sync, that term referring to what?
Music sync refers to in a film or television show when they, you know, drop the needle, so to speak, on a track and incorporate it, you know, centrally into the programming. So it can be kind of in the background. It can kind of be, you know, something that's used diegetically, which means it's written into the story itself, or it can just be kind of music that you're hearing that's sort of setting a vibe. And, you know, the way that they're used can kind of dictate whether or not people are interested or you know, care at all, or if it's, you know, really designed to be an important part of what you're consuming. But sometimes like this, it can be, you know, pretty important.
And we're coming out of a period where you're seeing a lot of profit growing from the touring entertainment industry. But overall, because of COVID, profits are still down. So when you're looking at the existence of a musician, getting a music sync like this is a good way to get paid outside of touring and selling merch. Right, Nate?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think in general, since, you know, in the last 20 years, music revenue is down a lot. You know, it's improving lately, but that's sort of relative to where it has been in the last few years. And then, yeah, with COVID, you know, touring revenue is still fighting back. Inflation is cutting at it. And I think, you know, this is a good slam dunk way to make some money. where, you know, previously some estates maybe would be a little bit more hesitant to offer up, you know, a music sync. You know, now they're like, yeah, let's talk. Let's figure out a way to do this.
That was one of the most interesting points that you bring up in your story for The Ringer, Nate, is that these legacy artists are way more willing to allow their music to be used in a sync, in a soundtrack, in a commercial than they might have been in the past. You talked to a lot of people that were saying these legacy acts are more willing to play the game.
Yeah, I mean, you might hear different things if you ask them point blank, but it's certainly, you know, just if you're paying attention to what you're watching, you'll notice it. It's definitely a thing. I mean, you'll see Bob Dylan and, you know, commercial for Airbnb recently or something like that. And, there was a time in which you would not hear sort of household names very often in programming. And I feel like just anecdotally, you know, you can really sense that that is shifting. And especially as we kind of move away from kind of monoculture film and television, where there's less focus on any single program, it's easier to make the case and easier to kind of fit it in there. But yeah, there's a noticeable increased willingness on the part of major artists. I think in the story, I mentioned one that really caught me off guard, which was in the new season of Russian Doll on Netflix. And they use Pink Floyd really heavily in that show. And I thought it was, that whole show has great music programming. I really liked the way that they used it. They used Shine On You Crazy Diamond in like a 5-minute sprawling scene. And it's really cool. I thought it was great, but it definitely caught me. It struck me as something that you probably wouldn't have seen even just 10 years ago.
Well, that's a great example when you think of Russian Doll, another Netflix show in that first season. Gotta Get Up by Harry Nilsson is a central plot device. I mean, it is written into the story to the point where I had never heard that song and I discovered it through the show. But it kind of reminds me when you're talking about this, Nate, it's the same thing with seeing actors get into TV or get into commercials decades ago that would have killed your career. You were only doing commercials in foreign markets. Now it's completely flattened. You see prestige A-list actors that would have only done film now do prestige TV. And it kind of feels that way with the way the internet is affecting music. It's kind of flattening everything out where the genres are done or what's cool is done. And you have everything at your fingertips at all times, including old music, which you point out is dominating the charts way more than new music.
Yeah, so, you know, this is sort of something that's sort of an ongoing source of research, and, you know, we'll kind of see how it shakes out over time. But, you know, old music is every year in the past couple of years is taking a leg up on new music just in terms of how much we are paying attention to it. And how much we're consuming it, and how much of the revenue share it takes. I think it was 70% of 2021's music revenue share was old music. So that's music that was not released within the last 18 months. And that was up, I think, 5% from the year before. And just in general, on streaming, last year, consumption of new music went down for the first time since they've been paying attention to it, just overall, not in relation to new music. So, or not in relation to old music, excuse me. So it's a distinct phenomenon that's going on right now. And it probably has a lot to do with the way that the charts are measuring things and the way that we use streaming, but it's distinctly happening. And it's worth paying attention to as the digital economy kind of settles in.
Yeah. You make the case in your story for The Ringer that, you know, if you were to hear that Kate Bush song on Stranger Things, you know, back in the 1980s, you would actually have to go and try to find that artist, find that CD in a physical store. Now it's right at your fingertips. You can Shazam it, you can Spotify it, and we're able to see how we're consuming music way more clearly. We have way better data of how we actually consume music. And one of the things you point out is that older people are streaming more and want to hear things that they know.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where it's simple when you think about it. You know, as streaming takes over and becomes the predominant way that people listen to music, that includes older demographics. And as we get older, we settle into music that we prefer to listen to. I think, you know, generally speaking, people tend to stop listening to as much new music the older they get. So you factor that in and into streaming being such a very precisely measured thing that you can tell down to the song, down to the stream, what people are listening to, and it'll start to affect, you know, the way that we understand what people are listening to. It's not only easier for people to listen to music, you know, old music, especially whenever they want to, it's also easier for us to tell how much old music they're listening to. So there's kind of two things going on at the same time, but I think it probably does generally reflect increased interest in old music than there was in previous generations just across the board. Because this phenomenon that we're talking about, the Kate Bush thing, a lot of it is driven by Gen Z. You know, they're really enjoying Stranger Things. They're enjoying this song. And they're the ones who have put it back on the charts. So that it's a number one hit in 8 countries, I think, something like that. You know, this is a global phenomenon. And it really does have a lot to do with the way that streaming is integrated into the way we consume music, which is just so different from any generation prior.
And streaming is not actually age dependent. No, so in other words, they're counting streams, but we don't really know demographically who those people are, because I think it is interesting. Like, I was just sort of thinking, I was around, Nate, I was around the first time that song came out. Okay. So so I think to myself, if I were in the same situation in reverse, like this would be the equivalent, if I were a younger person, say Ryan's age, or maybe your age, Nate, this would be the equivalent of being your age and listening to music from 1954 or something. Like, right. It didn't happen. Nobody did that. Nobody pulled up Connie Francis records in the 1980s and said, this is a cool new thing. Let's put this to number one. So it is older streaming that's a kind of accounting for this, I think. But as they break it down demographically, like, do we know if, in fact, younger people are embracing this older music in the same way that, you know, their older peers are?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's no way this happens without Gen Z, because, you know, just traditionally speaking in the music industry, you know, the young culture really drives what's happening, right? And just, you know, if you go on TikTok right now, you'll see it. It's there. Yep. It's hard to avoid. So it is really interesting. Yeah. You know, I'm trying to remember, you know, I'm a millennial, and I'm trying to remember exactly when I got into Kate Bush and how I got into her. And it just, I think the difference between what even was going on just 10 years ago and what's happening now is that it's capable of having this sort of viral moment that sweeps everyone in. Yeah. And it was harder for something like that to happen with old music before social media. And so there's a sort of hurricane kind of phenomenon that can happen now. And it seems almost slightly randomized, you know? I mean, it happened with Fleetwood Mac, with, you know, Dreams.
Yeah.
So they got, you know, super popular and made it back onto the charts because of a TikTok trend. And, you know, that wasn't a music sync. That was just a popular TikTok thing. And it legitimately put them back on the charts higher than they'd been on in decades. I believe that's accurate.
And all indications are that was an organic moment for Fleetwood Mac. But there are whole departments now at the remaining major labels, the people who control catalogs, who have large back catalogs, looking for songs to get out into the TikTok universe to try to create new hits again.
Yeah. And Nate, you bring that up in your story, you know, the idea of these legacy acts selling their catalogs, their publishing for these, you know, disgusting amounts of money. Well, now people want to be able to get those synced and make some profit off of that. I mean, that's a relationship that we're seeing on the back end, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that doesn't quite apply to Kate Bush because she's still in control of her catalog. So you have to kind of take that one step further. But at least when it comes to some of these catalogs that have been purchased recently for massive amounts of money, you know, Bob Dylan, Paul Simon, Stevie Nicks, they don't have, you know, there are certain stipulations that apply. I know Neil Young's in particular, his sale was contingent on certain level of control. But the reality is, in general, when you make that kind of sale of your entire catalog for the publishing like that, they're going to try to, you know, monetize it to make their money back. That's the whole reason they bought it. And, you know, you have to expect that, you know, they're going to be looking at ways in which it's effective to use, you know, these really wonderful catalogs of music that have so much potential to make money. And obviously, you know, an interesting thing about Running Up That Hill is that it's been in numerous shows over the past few years. I mean, this isn't the first time it was used. It was used in Glow. It was used in Vanity Fair. I think what you're going to see more of is these people who are in control of these estates now trying to find ways to generate viral moments, you know, artificially. And I don't know how possible that is, but it depends on how cynical you are. That might already be happening. I would say it's probably quite possible and probably to a degree already going on.
And that's what I think we need to start getting into the big picture here. When we actually look at the song itself, its lyrical content kind of gives it the ability to be placed in a lot of different situations, different soundtracks, different shows. Because it's this wide open narrative about the simple idea of stepping into someone else's shoes to understand. So you make the case that it's appealing in a lot of different situations for a lot of different audiences.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because Kate Bush is so well known for these really narrative songs. You know, Wuthering Heights, her first song, her debut single, was a number one hit, and you know, based on a Bronte novel. And that wasn't uncommon. She was very into world building. But this song is sort of an abstract kind of lyrical, you know, presentation of something that she was going through in her personal life, which was the idea of switching places with a romantic partner in order to, you know, run up that hill together and see things through one another, one of those eyes. And that's not really, you know, how people interpret it now, but it's so vague in the way that it's presented that you could use it almost however you want. I mean, the music supervisor on Stranger Things, I think her name is Nora Felder, who did just a fantastic job, obviously, with this whole show. I mean, this isn't the first time we're talking about music on Stranger Things. And, you know, I think the way she described it was much more within the character of Max and the show. You know, her need for love was what she explained it as being, how she felt about, you know, that song. And that's not really what Kate Bush has said quite explicitly what that song is about. It's not really about that, but it works just fine because it's sort of one of those songs that exists for anyone to implant their own emotions onto and to claim in their own way. The song has also been used and kind of claimed by the gay community as sort of an anthem of acceptance. And you see that kind of interpretation a lot. So it's wide open. There's a lot of ways in which Running Up That Hill is already sort of seeped into the consciousness, which is sort of what makes it interesting to me that it had such a moment like this, because it's not like it's a obscure song by any means. You know, most people had heard it. It was in the Olympics 10 years ago. It just is a monster of a song. It is just absolutely a dominating force.
The other big picture element that I think we need to break down here, Nate, and I'd really love to hear your take on this, is with old music becoming popular, maybe that's not the right phrase, with the dominance of legacy music right now on the charts, is it a threat to younger musicians? I mean, that idea of, if I've been in a band for a couple of years, I can't really compete with the familiarity of Pink Floyd or Bob Dylan. I mean, it seems like that obsession with the old could be dangerous for the new.
I think it certainly could. You know, just one way to look at it is that, you know, this is an investment from powerful investment groups that people are buying up these catalogs, right? You know, it takes a lot of power to put $500 million into buying Bruce Springsteen's catalog. And to compare that, you know, with what's going on with more working class side of musicians, I mean, that's always been hard, but it's getting harder. And there's a lot of growing pains going on with the digital economy for young artists. And just in general, you know, think about how much we're talking about new music these days. It's a thing, but it's, you know, we're not sitting here talking about Harry Styles right now.
Right.
So I think there is a legitimate concern sort of in the industry. And I think I share that concern that young music, you know, needs a little bit more help, young music, new music rather. And, you know, to make sure that they're not fighting against these, you know, massive estates with so much power and so much money and influence. And, you know, when I think the survey I cite in the story is one that says that something like 8% or 10% of musicians surveyed said that they were taking in 80 to 100% of their money, their income from music. Hmm. So pretty much everyone who identifies as a musician has other jobs. And, you know, I'd be curious to see what that number was, you know, 20, 40 years ago. But for that large portion of the musician group that is working day jobs, they're fighting against, you know, hedge funds right now. So best of luck to them. And maybe we need to, you know, all make a conscious effort to be, you know, paying attention to new music coming out and young artists and also enjoying Kate Bush, because there's enough room out there for great, you know, old music as well. This is something that Ann Powers, who I spoke to, the great writer, she pointed out, you know, maybe this isn't such a bad thing because so much great old music and the music industry is dominated by the need to create new stars and make money off of that. But there's no need to just leave old music behind and never talk about it again. So there is a nice middle ground, and maybe some of this is actually, you know, kind of healthy.
Rob doesn't agree.
No. there are some things I just don't see any reason to come. You know, like if it comes back, it comes back. We're talking about, though, the attention economy. And in fact, we were talking about it before we went on the air, Ryan, that if you are actually a new music consumer, what we consider in the industry a new music consumer, and suddenly you've discovered Running Up That Hill and it's your favorite song, and you go and stream that, I don't know, 10 times today because it's your favorite song. That's 40 minutes that you did not listen to anything new. Like, I mean, that's kind of disturbing. Like that would have been kind of a hard thing to do in, you know, 40 years ago when the thing first came out. You had to own it. If you wanted to do that, you had to own it. And the rest of the time you'd be listening to other music.
Well, the thing every time we have a conversation like this around cultural moments and music and the powers behind it, I just end up depressed. It's like staying at the zoo too long, where you're like, I'm looking at these animals in cages, and it makes me sad. And every time we have these conversations about the music industry, the answer is always, there's hundreds of millions of dollars at play. That's what's controlling this narrative. And I'm like, damn it. I didn't think it was going to be that again. But I guess I just keep opening the same box. I keep putting my hand back on the oven. And here we are. One thing I do want to wrap up with you, Nate, is this idea of cultural gatekeeping, which me and Rob were debating a lot. You know, if you felt like you discovered Kate Bush and it was sort of a personal thing for you and nobody in the world knew about Kate Bush but you, which I do think people did feel that way, huge in the UK, not so big in the United States. And then it ends up being, you know, part of this Stranger Things hot topicification of something where it becomes so popular, people feel a little butthurt about that.
Yeah, definitely. You know, there's a distinct amount of people who feel a little hurt by this. And you know, maybe this is a hot take on a hot take, but my personal feeling is that I'm sympathetic to people who feel a little hurt when an artist that they felt they had a special connection to becomes this, you know, overexposed in our culture. You know, it's not like no one should be naive about the reality of what the entertainment industry is like and how it works. But certainly, you know, when they're in a position where they're making, you know, using their music to make money through corporations, it's fair to be a little bummed out about it. And you know, just in general, I guess I think back onto the, you know, some songs that I've really loved that have gone kind of mainstream. You know, I wrote a story about Pavement, the band, and their song Harness Your Hopes, which became a huge hit on Spotify out of nowhere. And, you know, I never talked about this in the article, but I honestly had a deep connection to that song before it became
right,
a thing.
Right.
And I was, you know, part of the reason I wrote that story is because I wanted to understand how this happened. And so I guess what I'm saying is, you know, I understand. And I think that it's easy to take the high road on that one. But, you know, sometimes it can be a little cruel watching how the real world works. And, you know, that's life. But at the same time, you know, if Kate Bush is having a moment, that's great, because she's a fantastic artist. And I think anyone who really thinks about it will be thrilled for her and thrilled for all of us that we get to talk about it.
And you've been a fantastic guest, Nate Rogers, writer and editor based in Los Angeles, who recently wrote a story for The Ringer called Kate Bush Running Up That Hill and the End of Music Charts as We Knew Them. Nate, thank you so much. We'd love to have you back soon.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.